Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Here's a riddle. What tiny species exists in multiple forms, one of which was long carried by livestock, transmitted to large wild animals, has returned in some places to cattle, and has a remarkable ability to get ranchers, hunters, conservationists, and wildlife managers really upset? The answer is brucellosis, a bacteria which, among other things, can precipitate abortions. For several decades, debate has raged about the disease in Yellowstone Park bison and how to minimize risks of its transmission to cattle. And now, brucellosis has been confirmed in wild elk. Neil Anderson knows about all this. He's supervisor of the Wildlife Laboratory of the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Neil, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little about your background. Where'd you grow up?
I actually grew up in the Black Hills of South Dakota, a little town called Custer, pretty close to Mount Rushmore. My folks had a place about 13 miles out of town. We had Forest Service on kind of both sides of us, and spent a lot of my time out in those woods.
Is that where you got interested in wildlife or science, or what's that
story?
Yeah,
between that and avid hunter, have been my whole life. My dad hunts, so that's part of it too. But yeah, it's just being out in that environment, surrounded by nature, hunting, fishing, camping.
What'd your folks do?
My dad is a lineman for the local Rural Electric Association, and my mom stayed at home but also worked as a bookkeeper for a family business. They built power lines.
How about your education?
I have a bachelor's degree from South Dakota State University and then a master's degree from Montana State University, all in wildlife management.
When you decided on that major, what did you expect? What did you figure you'd learn?
Well, actually, I first started out in engineering. I thought engineering would be the course I wanted to go, but I looked at where I might have to live, the things I might have to do. And really, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a wildlife biologist. Didn't really hear much about it growing up. I started looking into it, found out about it, and thought it seemed like a pretty good fit. Had a lot of interest. Always wanted to be outside. Always wanted to work with wildlife.
When did you get your master's and start working as a wildlife biologist?
I finished my master's in 1993. Worked part-time both as a technician in the lab and in various other places. But started as a biologist with the lab, the wildlife lab in Bozeman, in 1995.
How has that work been in real life to you compared with your expectations? What's the same? What's different?
You know, I think most people who go into wildlife, there's this expectation that you're going to be doing a lot of time working primarily with wildlife.
Yeah.
The reality is it's a lot more of a social type job where you're working with people. Probably most of your job is working with people, working with other groups, you know, your constituents. And the wildlife part of it is what you kind of ends up being almost a minor part of it. It's what you want to focus on. It's what you're interested in and what you're working for. But the reality is we work with a variety of different people. Wildlife is held in trust for the people of Montana, and everybody has an opinion. Everybody has an opinion on how it should be managed. So really what in our jobs, not just my job, but we kind of get caught in the middle of all that. And it's trying to balance different expectations, different priorities, and come out with something that really is best for the people of Montana, but also helps make sure that we conserve Montana's wildlife.
Okay, I appreciate that's almost a statement of the department's mission. We had Jeff Hagener on the show, your director of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. That reflects the reality of sort of the human element of wildlife management. But I'm guessing that when you went into wildlife biology, that's not what you figured.
Yeah, that's fair.
So how's it been? Because if you think you're going to be dealing with wildlife, I remember we had a guy on the show, I think his name's Denver Holt, he wanted to be an owl biologist. And he decided, you know what, I'm going to end up dealing with a lot of people and pushing a lot of paper. If I become an institutional biologist, I'm going to go out on my own. And he does owl research on his own up in the Flathead. How's it been for you? Clearly that had to be a surprise.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise, but I'm maybe a little bit more fortunate in my position sometimes because even though I work in the lab, I do have opportunities to go out and work on different projects and actually get hands-on experience and mm-hmm. opportunities with wildlife, whether it's capture operations or research. So that's been a good thing as far as I'm concerned. But you never get outside enough.
Yeah, I've noticed. Yeah. What is the wildlife laboratory?
Basically, it's called a laboratory, but we don't do a lot of diagnostic testing. We're the only lab, technically, for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. We're located out of Bozeman. And we do almost all the wildlife health type stuff. I like to tell people a lot of other folks in our agency look at animals from the outside and how they interact with their environment and people. And we look at them kind of from the inside out. So we get involved in everything from reproduction, physiology, health information, as well as disease-type issues. And I would say that the disease issues have grown over the years and probably dominates what we do right now.
I need a little help. My thinking of a laboratory is you do research. Do you do the research into these animal health? You say you go inside the animals, but I think you said you didn't do a lot of research at the lab. So help me understand that.
Sure. We do a little bit of research. It's probably not our main focus. In reality, is what we do is we provide a service for our management biologists. We provide technical information. We also help with other research biologists in the state as far as expertise on diseases, animal handling, those type of things.
Okay, do you guys have the expertise, or do you contract out for studies, or how do you get the information you pass on to the wildlife biologists?
We have a lot of expertise in our department. We have a veterinarian on staff, myself. I've worked with wildlife diseases now for almost 20 years. The way our lab is structured, the actual research component where we are the primary investigators of a research project mm-hmm. is somewhat limited. We do a fair number of projects. Most of what we do is try to provide information for someone else, like a research biologist doing a project, or a wildlife manager who has to make a decision about how do I manage wildlife with a disease concern. For instance, in my job, I conduct CWD surveillance, so chronic wasting disease. We look for that. I'm one of the primary investigators in our brucellosis project on elk. I also get involved in some research as far as reproduction on primarily fur bears. We've done some food habits type studies on different animals as well.
Let's talk about brucellosis now with that background. Tell us about what it is as an organism. That I was surprised in doing a little research, this multifaceted organism, correct?
That's correct. There are different species of brucella. What we're dealing with in Montana, primarily in the greater Yellowstone area, and the disease that's causing all the controversy is brucella abortus. That's the name of the bacteria. And it causes disease in cattle, elk, and bison, primarily in this area. There are other diseases out there. There's a brucella militensis, which causes diseases in goats. There's a brucella suis that causes disease in swine or pigs. Those really aren't all that prevalent in Montana, and we don't know that they even exist in this state.
In reading this, the background that I did, people can be infected by some variations of brucellosis.
Yes, that's correct. And generally, it's termed indolent fever. And it's fairly debilitating. It's something you don't want.
Is that a concern in relation to the brucellosis that's in the park that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I think people need to be aware that it can cause disease in people. It's not as deadly or as significant as brucella militensis. In our country, we've done a lot to reduce the risk to people. Really, it's been primarily eliminated or almost eliminated in the livestock industry, except for a few cases that are reoccurring now in the greater Yellowstone area. But things like pasteurized milk, those type of things also help to eliminate the risk of that disease.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Neil Anderson, Wildlife Laboratory Supervisor for the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, about brucellosis. Now, tell us the story about Yellowstone and brucellosis. How did it get here in Yellowstone bison?
It's arrived with domestic cattle, probably back around the turn of the century, early 1900s. Most likely was transmitted to bison through a cattle.
How does that happen?
It occurs primarily through a birth event or an abortion. This disease proliferates in the body, and when an animal like a cow or a bison or an elk gets to its third trimester, the bacteria really proliferates in the reproductive tracts, resulting in an abortion. When that fetus is aborted, the fluids, all the birth material, contaminates some of the vegetation. There's a lot of bacteria in that. another animal comes by, consumes that, and then is exposed or infected.
That's how it got into Yellowstone bison, presumably.
A lot of people don't realize that the park was actually used as a cattle ranch at one time, or parts of it were.
I forgot that.
So there was commingling of wildlife, bison, elk, with cattle at that time. And it was probably occurring outside the park as well. And that's the most likely route of transmission into wildlife.
Okay, so now bison end up having brucellosis from cattle. If I understand correctly, the livestock industry in the 20th century worked very hard to eliminate brucellosis from cattle herds for obvious reasons.
Yes, that's correct.
So now what?
Basically, the cattle industry has done that. They basically eliminated brucella from everywhere in the United States, with the exception of the greater Yellowstone area, where we have these kind of recurring transmission events that are believed to come now from wildlife.
How long have we had the reverse problem, at least understood it? In other words, to the best of your knowledge, when did we see cattle being reinfected by Yellowstone bison?
In 1985, Montana gained its brucellosis-free status. In other words, at that point, it was believed that the cattle industry in Montana no longer had brucellosis in its cattle herds. We went 24 years without any cases in Montana. Then all of a sudden in 2007, we got that first case again, and then another one in 2008. And the reason we think that it probably came from elk is based on the testing that they've done in cattle. Basically, if you get a cattle herd, your herd is tested positive. They go and they test all the cows in your herd. They test all the cows in the adjacent herds, and they test herds that you may have traded with. And based on those findings, as well as some genetic information that suggests that the bacteria that they find in cattle and elk is very similar.
Okay, you've just introduced a new species. We were talking bison, but you're saying, if I understand you, that these incidents seem to have come from elk.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with where the proximity of the cases are and where bison exist. The cases have occurred in areas where we don't have bison. But they have occurred in areas where we do have elk, and in areas that we know we have brucellosis in those elk populations.
Okay, let's take it one step at a time. I go back in Montana 25 years, and my recollection is that the concern for a reinfection of cattle was focused on bison during that period of time prior to 2000, and going back into the 1980s.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think there's still that concern out there. You know, don't want to get too much into the bison issue, but there's a lot of different programs and activities that are going on to basically limit where bison go on the landscape and their ability to come in contact with cattle.
Doesn't that, in fact, originate out of the concern that bison would infect cattle? There's been a controversy for 20 years in this state with bison.
Yes, and that controversy is still there.
Okay.
We still have the disease in bison. Just because there hasn't been a documented case of transmission from bison to cattle doesn't mean it can't occur.
So that's the origin then of the, because there's been a lot of arguments about this, whichever side you're on, and I'm not asking you to take a position in the side of the argument, but in terms of getting the background information, I remember just a lot of controversy about shooting bison coming out of the park, quarantines, different methods which were designed, correct me if I'm wrong, to minimize the risk of transmission, in part.
In part, yep. Some of those activities were also to help manage populations.
Okay.
Primarily hunting and those type of things.
In terms of what we know about this, what's the situation with bison, the rate of infestation of brucellosis in the park herd?
Bison, what we call it seroprevalence. So basically we test these animals, we test blood, and it tells us exposure. It doesn't tell us how many animals are actively infected. There's a little bit of a difference there.
All right.
Just because you're exposed doesn't mean you can pass that bacteria on to something else. It just says you have the antibodies in your blood. In bison, that prevalence, that seroprevalence, typically runs right around 45% and doesn't vary a lot.
Now, given my history going back, I've heard a lot about the quote-unquote risk to cattle from bison transmission. The elk-generated transmission came as a shock to me. I'm assuming it did to a lot of other people. Did it surprise you?
You know, I think we were a little bit surprised by what happened, but not terribly surprised because we knew we had it in certain areas. But prevalence historically had been really, really low in elk. And the distribution of where we found it in elk was pretty small. However, in the last 10, 15 years, we started seeing an increasing seroprevalence in a lot of areas. We started finding positive animals in places where we hadn't found them before. That might be a combination of a lot of different things, elk movement changes, better testing, as well as maybe a change in the distribution of the disease.
What's the population of elk in Montana? 200,000, something like that?
Yeah, the population of elk is roughly around 200,000.
Okay, that's a lot different than bison.
It is a lot different than bison.
I'm just going to spin this out. Tell me when I make a mistake. If you have brucellosis in elk, potentially the implications for interface with livestock are multiples of bison. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. The reality is where we find brucellosis in elk is still pretty limited.
Really?
It's in the greater Yellowstone area. But you do have a lot more a potential for intermixing or commingling of elk and cattle just because they're much more widespread.
And going back to something that you said at the near the top of the show in terms of your experience, part of wildlife management, a big part, has to do with dealing with people who either are hunters or, let's say, livestock interests that have concerns about disease or competing for forage or fence damage. So, again, correct me if I'm wrong, the discovery, I'm going to call it, of potential or likely transmission of brucellosis from elk to cattle must have raised a lot of serious management questions.
Yeah, and it still does today. Reality are elk objectives, so basically how many animals we can say we have on the ground, isn't based just on biology. It's based on social issues, and a lot of that is tolerance for elk in the landscape. This disease lowers that tolerance. Because of the risk of transmission to cattle, there's a heightened concern for those folks who are raising cattle in this area, and a lot of our winter ranges are on private property. So the reality is that elk during winter come down to these private properties during the high-risk period, which is basically from January through the calving period.
And the calving period is like May, June?
Middle of June.
So that's a big chunk of time. A fair number of animals are potentially intermingling.
That's correct. And if elk are allowed to commingle with those cattle and there's an abortion event, then there's a potential for a transmission to cattle.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about brucellosis with Neil Anderson, Wildlife Laboratory Supervisor, the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. All right, now we have a situation where we have a much more numerous species potentially interfacing at a risk period with livestock from January to roughly half of the year in a certain part of Montana.
Yeah, primarily in the greater Yellowstone area.
Okay. What do you do about it?
Part of what we're looking at is, because we've seen these increases, we're worried about where this disease is in elk. Has it changed its distribution? Mm-hmm. So we have a project where we're actually going to different areas around the greater Yellowstone area and testing for brucellosis by capturing elk. We're also putting radio collars on those elk, trying to find out what that geographical distribution of the disease is, as well as get some information on how this disease might move between different elk populations.
How long is that study going to take?
We are in the fourth year of a five-year study, and then we'll step back after that, and then we'll reevaluate the direction we want to go, if this is something we need to continue, and if we have the funding to continue.
What do you expect to know at the end of this five-year study, not just you personally, but the science that you can advise the department with, that you didn't know in the beginning of the study?
What we hope to know is exactly where this disease exists in elk populations so we can have that boundary of where we have it, where we don't. And we'll also learn quite a bit about the risk of this disease of transmitting to other populations as well as to cattle.
How do you find out the first? In other words, how do you find out the risk of X elk population transmitting to Y population in a different geographical or neighboring geographical area through this study?
Because of the radio collars, we'll get some good movement information. So really, the only way for this disease to move from population to population is in an animal. So if you have an infected elk and it moves to a completely different animal and goes to a completely different winter range, then there's some risk of a transmission event.
Just so I can get a handle on the scale of this, over a five-year period, about how many elk are you going to physically come in contact with, collaring or otherwise?
The goal is to capture about 100 elk in each area in a given year.
In each area?
In each area. So basically we go into an area, we capture 100 elk, we put 30 radio collars on those elk. The next year we go to a different area, we capture 100 elk, we put 30 radio collars out.
Different areas within the greater Yellowstone?
Just outside of the boundary where we know we have the disease in elk. And that's how we try to establish where that boundary is. We're hoping at one point we'll find a spot where we just don't find it in elk, so then we've established where that boundary is.
Let's fast forward a year. You've got the information you hope to get from the five-year study. What do you do with it?
This information even currently is leading towards management decisions that affect not only wildlife, but livestock. Right now, in livestock, they have a designated surveillance area for brucellosis.
All right.
That is based on where we find this disease in elk. So every time we find a new case or new population that might have it, the line changes, which includes then more livestock producers. But this information is also being used by our department to make management decisions on what really our goal would be, is to keep elk and cattle separate in those areas where we have brucellosis.
All right, I'm going to say this back to you. Use the data to refine your boundaries where you apply management techniques to keep these animals separate as much as possible.
Yes.
How do you keep elk and cattle separate? These are wild animals. They don't read signs. What do you do in the physical world?
Yeah, and that's going into what the department has done. We actually had a working group, a 12-person working group, that came up with some ideas of what you might be able to do to keep elk and cattle separate. And those ideas or those options are fairly limited. We don't have vaccines. We don't have a lot of things to try to treat this disease. Removal of elk, whole-scale removal of elk, testing, and then slaughtering animals was not one of the things that was considered, and it's not on the plate. So basically we're talking about hazing elk, potentially limited fencing of feed grounds or feed lots, feed lines. And then there's a potential for some small-scale limited hunting, even later in the year than we typically would hunt before. Typically we'd end seasons about the middle of February. Under these new guidelines, there's actually the opportunity to hunt clear into May. But the whole idea, I think, is pretty important to understand. The whole idea is to change the distribution of elk, and it's not a population control mechanism.
It's a matter of trying to shift where elk are as opposed to the numbers of elk. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Basically, what we're trying to do is, through these management guidelines, is change where those elk are during the risk period.
So you have these potential limited management tools, fencing, hazing, late season hunts. What evidence do you have, or do other states have in different areas, that these techniques are functional, that they achieve the desired result?
Really, we're in the early stages of this. These guidelines have only been in place for a couple of years, and we're going to learn as we go. So we're just starting to use some of these type of tools. So the evaluation is ongoing. It'll probably be one of those things where we learn and we adapt and try to figure out what does work and what doesn't work. Certainly something that works in one area may not work in another area. There's a lot of variation on the landscape.
This sounds to me, as a former Fish and Game Commissioner in the state of California, as interesting, new, experimental, practical research, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I think it is fair. The goal is to try to engage local areas. So the citizenship in a local community will help guide or direct where some of this management goes so that it can be more effective.
All right, now there's an interesting assumption there. The assumption is you can get local people from different interests, hunters, conservationists / environmentalists, livestock owners, just to pick those groups that have a clear interest, to constructively engage in a pragmatic process over time. Is that a fair summary of your hope?
That is the hope.
All right. From my experience as a citizen of Montana is that elk are an emotionally charged species to elk hunters. You said the public trust, their people very, they feel very possessive and proud of the Montana elk. Livestock owners, just to pick two interests, have a very deep history and pretty emotional about the risks that they perceive. How's that going? In other words, you can have a conversation, but it can be an acrimonious conversation. You're anticipating cooperation.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, we're early in this process. The idea is to form these localized working groups. And we're still developing that process. There aren't a lot of working groups in place right now. Who's on the committee, how they're structured, those things are all being worked out right now. This is going to be an ongoing process. And there will probably be a fair amount of trial and error just to see what works.
I've done a fair amount of environmental facilitation, and who you get at the table often determines how reasonable the discussion is. How's it going so far? Where are you guys in this process?
For example, in the Northern Paradise Valley, we have had late-season brucellosis management hunts where a very small number of elk have been harvested in an effort to try to keep elk separate from cattle. And overall, there seems to be some value in that.
What does that mean? How's the landowners respond?
I think for overall, the landowners' response has been fairly favorable.
In other words, the late-season hunt has, from their standpoint, affected the distribution of elk?
And I think that's true, yeah. It has affected the distribution of elk. The question is, how long does that distribution affect it? Is it only when the hunters are out there, and as soon as the hunters leave, the elk come back? And there is an element of that, and that's why these hunts are usually spread over a longer period of time.
I have to say, I think this is a gutsy call for the department because, in fact, you have very strong emotional interests and feelings around these issues. People would, I think some say, get rid of the elk. Some people would say, get rid of the cattle. That's an either-or. What do you say to that?
I think the reality is that what we need to do is get all the parties together so they can kind of come to consensus. The only way we're going to effectively manage this disease, and that's what we're trying to do is manage this disease, is to have cooperation from a lot of different stakeholders. If we don't have that, then things just don't work.
You've been engaged in this work for 20 years just about. You know Montanans. How do you think that's going to work?
I think most Montanans are pretty level-headed, and they want what's best for everybody. They don't want to see landowners pushed off their landscape. They want to make sure that we have abundant elk populations. And it's trying to get those folks to come to the table and agree on how best to do that.
Neil Anderson, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.